You are listening to an ADIS podcast.
Welcome to our podcast. My name's Bob Shin. I'm a neurologist at MedStar Georgetown University Hospital. I'm joined by two of my colleagues for this conversation.
I'm Joe Berger. I'm a professor of neurology at the University of Pennsylvania and associate chief of the Division of Multiple Sclerosis.
And we also have joining us Dr. Pavle Repovic.
Hello. I am a neurologist in Seattle at Swedish Neuroscience Institute, Multiple Sclerosis Center, role position of a medical director for neurology research.
So the three of us are going to have a conversation focusing on challenges in optimal MS care during this COVID-19 pandemic, and then cover some best practices from our point of view. There have been a lot of concerns surrounding COVID-19, just from a medical standpoint and certainly within the MS space. We can just start the conversation with what we're thinking in terms of these unique concerns.
There are actually, in my mind, three concerns to the MS community. One is, what does COVID-19 do to the course of MS? Is COVID-19 going to increase your risk of having a relapse? We know from data that had been generated years ago by Bill Sibley that viruses in general seem to be a risk for increased relapse of this disease. But curiously, we've not seen this really with COVID-19. We've seen pseudo-relapses, but relapses don't seem to be terribly much more prevalent with people who get infected, who are MS patients, than you'd expect otherwise. So number two is, what does MS and MS treatments do to the course of COVID? And then question number three is more for the MS community of physicians, and that is, are there illnesses that look like MS that are triggered by COVID-19? And it turns out there are. We're going to focus largely on the effects of MS and, more importantly, disease-modifying therapies on the course of COVID-19. But I think you shouldn't forget about these others as well.
I think we're in agreement that it doesn't look like people living with MS are intrinsically more vulnerable to COVID-19 infection. I think
that's,
we can agree on that.
Correct. That's all been right. Looked at. And unless they have, the people with MS who are at increased risk are those individuals that have those same risks as individuals without MS. In other words, obesity, metabolic syndrome, diabetes, lung disease, cardiac disease, the age, being a male, those things increase one's risk, whether you have MS or you don't have MS.
What about, let's say, our treatments for multiple sclerosis? They're immunomodulatory, immunosuppressant. From your point of view, Dr. Repovic, how should we be factoring this into our conversation in COVID-19 and MS?
So specifically with regard to the risk of COVID, I'm aware of one study that looked at the health claims data. That's Tony Reeder's study with about 25,000 insurance claims, where they were able actually to draw some conclusions about different disease-modifying therapies and the risk of being diagnosed with COVID. For most MS therapies, that risk was sort of at the base, at the background level, if you will. There were no differentiators. For injectable therapies, interferons and glatiramer, I think some of the B-cell therapies, CD20 targeting therapies, there was an increased risk. So from that study, which is sizable, one might conclude that there is perhaps an increased risk, but it's always important to remember that these sorts of studies carry potential biases, and some of which may not be really accounted for, such as age, behavior patterns, and vaccination status too. As far as the risk of more severe COVID, I have to say that the data that I look at for this largely is derived from national COVID databases, including the one in the United States, Italy, France, Sweden, Spain, perhaps. So a combination of those, or rather collaborative effort between those and some others recently published in Neurology, suggests that, again, for most MS therapies, there is no increased risk of being hospitalized, that's a surrogate of severity of COVID, or being admitted to the ICU. But the exception to that rule, or rather to that trend, was seen with patients who are on ocrelizumab and rituximab, with more of those patients having an increased risk of being hospitalized. So I would say that it suggests that, at least for those populations, there might be an increased risk of being hospitalized.
I always think it's interesting you brought up the concern that there's something about B-cell therapies that may either increase risk of infection or predispose to more severe infection. Before we talk about that a little more, I think we should take just a moment to sketch out current thinking about immune responses in general. Maybe Dr. Berger, if you could, if we're just giving a very simple like outline of what is the immune response.
I'm happy to do that. Recall that when you are exposed to a novel antigen, and for almost all of us, COVID-19, the SARS-CoV-2 virus is novel. The component of the immune system that deals with it is the innate immune system. And that's can be quite a considerable immune response and protect you in a way that you never ever develop significant infection and allows time for the adaptive immune system to kick in. And what happens with the adaptive immune system? There are two components to it. One is humoral immunity, where the plasma cells start generating antibodies, and the other is the cell-mediated response. Now, the antibodies that you generate, and these are generated after vaccination, both that and the cell-mediated response, the antibodies that you generate bind to the spike protein of SARS-CoV-2 and prevent that virus from adhering to the angiotensin-converting receptor 2 that's on certain cells. So it actually prevents infection. You have high antibody levels, it may prevent infection. The cell-mediated response that you have is probably more important, because what it does is it gets into the infected tissues and it clears out the virus from those infected tissues. We have a large number of patients on B-cell therapies in our practice, and we really haven't seen that they have a higher risk of severe disease as evidenced by increased hospitalization or death. On the other hand, I am aware of what's come out of the registries, and what it appears is that there is a slight increased risk over the rest of the MS population in these patients of hospitalization, not of death per se, but of hospitalization. And it sort of makes sense, because the humoral response, as we know from a number of studies, it can be abrogated by the administration of a B-cell depleter. On the other hand, at least some of the studies have demonstrated that the T-cell mediated response is unaffected. And if it is affected, it seems to be more robust in these patients that have been treated with drugs like ocrelizumab than we see in a control population. So while you may have lowered the humoral response, the cell mediated response may be more robust than you would otherwise see. I think by and large, it's something that we should be concerned about, but we shouldn't be overly concerned about. Sir William Osler, who, you know, was a world-renowned internist, said, medicine is a science of uncertainty and an art of probability. We certainly have to apply that when it comes to COVID. We just don't know enough to make real strong recommendations, in my opinion.
Right. And I think all of us have had patients who have come to us and say, oh, should I get antibody, you know, my COVID-19 antibody, should I get them checked? You know, do I have protection? How do you counsel your patients, or sort of what is your take on those observations?
So the topic of testing antibody titers to SARS-CoV-2 in MS patients who have been vaccinated for the purpose of determining the efficacy of that vaccination is pretty fraught, I would say, with pitfalls. So I definitely don't recommend testing antibodies to SARS-CoV-2 in all of the patients. That said, when a person is particularly nervous about their own return to work plans, for example, there's a situation that I recently had to deal with where an individual was facing a request by their employer to return to their place of employment where there isn't a vaccine mandate and masking is not particularly strictly enforced. We had to make a decision what to do with them. Now, the data so far from the anti-SARS-CoV-2 investigation suggests that somewhere around 20 to 30% of people on ocrelizumab or rituximab generate antibodies, but majority don't. So there is a possibility that a person might have this or not, and you could use that perhaps to justify to the employer why this individual should perhaps be allowed to work from home for another period of time. Again, it's not a perfect situation, and I fully recognize that this is not something that will everybody will agree with. But for us in that sort of situation, it did make sense.
I have to admit, in my own practice, I strongly discourage my patients from getting antibody testing in this context. I did want to throw one more question in this area to you, which is, we've been focusing a lot on B-cell therapies. Do you think the evidence suggests that B-cell therapies are all essentially created equal? Is it basically just all anti-CD20 agents have the same effect, or have we seen differences comparing the different anti-CD20 agents?
They certainly have similar mechanism of action, but the data, at least the one we've referenced or alluded to so far, would actually not point out that they're all interchangeable. So from these national registries, the risk with rituximab appeared to be somewhat higher than with ocrelizumab and for ofatumumab. So I think there may still be some shades of differentiation between them in terms of risk and in terms of immune compatibility with vaccines.
I think, although the studies are still preliminary, it appears that the ability to generate antibodies with ofatumumab as opposed to ocrelizumab is somewhat higher. So a higher percentage of individuals who are treated with ofatumumab who get the vaccine seem to generate a measurable antibody response.
Well, I do think it is interesting, as you hinted at, that it's early. And we're just really learning about this, but there have been a number of reports that have suggested that the ability to see an antibody response might be higher in patients who had received ofatumumab versus some of the other, let's say, the infused anti-CD20 agents. And we were starting to see differences in the likelihood that one might develop hypo-IgG, for example. Again, may or may not really be relevant in this context. But again, the idea that maybe they're not all created equal. I did want to shift the conversation. I do think we need to talk about vaccination. We keep getting different recommendations from different agencies on who should be getting vaccinated, when you should be getting vaccinated, you know, should you be getting a booster. But if we focus in specifically on MS patients, how have you been counseling your patients in terms of should they be getting the COVID-19 vaccine? If so, are there special timing considerations?
So I think MS patients should absolutely be vaccinated against COVID. I think there was certainly a lot of concern initially among patients and clinicians, how these vaccines would play out and how safe they would be and so forth. I would probably say that our own personal experience with vaccines over this past year has supported that sense that, you know, the relapses of MS do not appear to be more common following vaccination. And so I do recommend vaccination against COVID to all of my patients, whether or not they've had COVID before, and regardless of which disease-modifying therapy they're on. because, you know, any protection is better than no protection.
I think it's great. You know, I still occasionally encounter resistance. People say, well, they haven't studied the vaccine specifically in people with multiple sclerosis, or we don't have enough time. But I feel like our message should be quite firm. You know, everyone needs to get vaccinated. Everybody with multiple sclerosis needs to get vaccinated. But Dr. Berger, what do you think about timing recommendations that have been put out there?
I agree with Pavlik and with you that every patient needs to be vaccinated. Now, where it becomes an issue is the timing with the infusion B-cell depleters, because what's been demonstrated, starting with the Veloci trial, is that individuals that receive vaccines following infusions anti-CD20 monoclonal antibodies do not mount the same antibody response as individuals that are on other disease-modifying therapies. So the question then becomes, what's the ideal timing following the six-month infusions? And the recommendation has been wait at least 3 months after the infusion, preferably 4, but don't get too close to the next infusion because that'll attenuate the response. So if you have a vaccine, if it's the initial series of vaccine, and it's an mRNA vaccine, and you're giving it at 21 days or 28 days, you've got to time it so that that second vaccine is given at least a month before the infusion occurs. And that would be ideal. The problem is that life isn't like that. I mean, it's much messier. So I have what I call my potential patient scenarios. Let's talk about the unvaccinated population first. So there are patients that come into your office who have not been on a disease-modifying therapy, who you want to start on an anti-CD20, and they've not been vaccinated. Some of those patients may have a disease like primary progressive MS. I think that it's quite acceptable to hold off on the infusions until you have that person fully vaccinated. That makes sense to me. On the other hand, you'll have patients with rip-roaring, relapsing, remitting MS, and you say to yourself, look, I got to get this disease under control. And the disease is much more important to you than the COVID-19 at that time, because that's only a possibility. So those people, I start on the drug. And in fact, in terms of vaccinating them, depending on where they live, if they're in an area of high risk COVID-19, I just say, go ahead and get vaccinated. Then you have those individuals who have been vaccinated already, and you're now talking about administering a booster. And there, in those instances, I think you have a lot more latitude because they've already been vaccinated. So in those individuals, I've been saying, you know what, wait a minimum of 3 months after your infusion. And let's get, we'll give you the booster then. With the exception of individuals that live in high risk COVID-19 areas, I might want to get them boosted sooner. But again, it's the art of medicine, not the science of medicine.
Sure. Pavle, do you practice in a similar way?
Definitely not sticking to these timelines as some sort of a rigid guideline. So the initial vaccination series earlier this year, of course, everybody who wants to get vaccinated wanted to get vaccinated yesterday. And I wasn't going to stand in their way and, you know, insist on a 3-month waiting period. But now with the boosters, what we are doing, actually, we're looking at a schedule of people who are, you know, scheduled for infusion in 1 to 2 months from now. And we're contacting them and asking them if they've gotten boosters. It has generated that sort of a discussion of, you know, if we are trying to find the optimal time, how do we communicate that to a large number of patients who remain on these therapies so they can take advantage of that window, presumably optimal window of opportunity.
It does sound like we all had a very similar approach. The priority at least initially, was for our patients to get vaccinated. Trying to be sensitive to time, it may have been a factor, but the priority was to get them vaccinated. But actually 100% agree really with both of you that when it comes to the booster concept, here, I think we do have the luxury of time. I did want to leave some time, you know, Dr. Berger, you had your three points that you wanted to bring up. Maybe you can flesh it out what you were hinting at, that COVID-19 infection does appear to be associated with a variety of different post-infectious complications.
We do know that illnesses like acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, optic neuritis, neuromyelitis optica, and neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder, transverse myelitis, all of these, which can look like MS, have been reported in the face of acute COVID-19. To me, it's not surprising because we see this with other viral illnesses as well. It's not unique to COVID-19. And in fact, the frequency with which it occurs is not very high. It's just that some of these presentations can be mistaken for multiple sclerosis. And physicians need to be aware that there are autoimmune diseases that can be triggered by COVID-19. Interestingly, we tend to conceptualize these complications as occurring 2 to 3 weeks after the infection, but with COVID-19, most of the reports suggest that they occur concurrently. It's not that it can't occur after, some do, but while you have acute infection, you may develop your optic neuritis or your acute disseminated encephalomyelitis.
Well, I guess in the MS world, we're increasingly being vigilant for things like aquaporin-4 antibodies and MOG antibodies. And, you know, so I think certainly when we're seeing something that looks like MS evolving after COVID-19 infection, I'm definitely wondering if it's another type of autoantibody.
So I will say that both have been reported, case reports, following COVID-19. That is aquaporin-4 positivity with NMO and anti-MOG with the NMOSD.
Just one other comment related to sequela of COVID that might look like MS. We're still not entirely sure about the prevalence of long COVID symptoms, sort of like these protracted recovery, and whether that's more likely to occur in multiple sclerosis patients. The large UK-based study suggested that individuals with greater disability with pre-existing anxiety and women tend to have actually higher odds of developing long COVID, that's MS patients specifically. So I think that I often reference that when I discuss the rationale for COVID vaccination with my vaccine hesitant patients, because you know, they really do need to understand that their odds of some of these outcomes are not always trivial.
Pavle, you had hinted at the idea of treatment of COVID-19 with certain kinds of antibody therapies. Did you want to give us any thoughts on that approach?
So as far as the treatment options against COVID, specifically with our MS disease modifying therapies, I've welcomed the FDA emergency use authorization for the use of monoclonal antibodies in people who are on medications that can interfere with vaccine efficacy. I routinely make it a point of letting my patients on B-cell therapies and S1Ps know that if they should become infected with COVID, they should seek this treatment.
So I did want to try to summarize things a little bit. You know, we started talking about risk from COVID-19 or of expression of COVID-19 infection for individuals with MS. We agree that for the most part, our patients with MS are not at increased risk from the infection, and that for the most part is regardless of what disease-modifying therapy they're on. We did spend a lot of time focusing in on anti-CD20 agents in particular, based on certain observations that might have raised a question of whether there is less immunity. But it seems as though we're still using the anti-CD20 agents. We still believe that the risk-benefit profile tilts in favor of using it for the appropriate patients. We also spent a lot of time talking about vaccination issues, which I think we agree people living with MS benefit from vaccination, really, regardless of what therapy they're on. And, you know, Pavla, you mentioned we need to keep or just make sure that they're aware that if they were to have symptoms of COVID, they should seek attention as soon as possible, you know, for the opportunity of treatments like monoclonal antibody therapies. I want to give each of you an opportunity to give a last some last thoughts or any other reflections you might want to have on how things have changed in our practice during this pandemic.
Well, things have changed tremendously since we began seeing patients via telemedicine, something that was not available to us before. I do think that there's a tremendous convenience for some patients to see them via telemedicine, particularly those that find it very difficult to get into the clinic, travel long distances, those that have physical disabilities. I will add, and this will be my concluding remarks before I turn it over to Pavla, I think that SARS-CoV-2, the virus, is going to be an endemic virus, and we'll just simply get accustomed to it, and we'll make accommodations for it, and we'll have better treatments come out with drugs other than antibodies. In a year's time, if the three of us get together, there's every possibility we're going to say something quite different than what we said tonight. And it reminds me of what Ralph Waldo Emerson said, which is, foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds. So I would think that, you know, as we learn more, we're just going to modify our opinions.
All right, Dr. Repovich, any final thoughts or reflections?
Our responsibility to our patients remains to treat their MS in the best, most effective, and most reasonable way. We may all get really wrapped up in a twisted in a pretzel over the vaccine, over the COVID, over telemedicine, over everything. But at the end of the day, we truly have to keep the eye on the goal, which is to treat this disease as best we possibly can. So sacrificing effective therapies because they carry certain risks is literally shooting ourselves in the foot. But being mindful of those risks is the first step to reducing them. Recognizing who is at a higher risk, figuring out how to mitigate it, either through the use of preventative monoclonal antibodies or some other prophylactic methods or something else, is our next challenge. Because I agree with Dr. Berger that the virus is here to stay.
I really appreciate the opportunity to spend time with the two of you. I actually learned a lot in this during this podcast from you. Thank you both.
You are listening to an ADIS podcast. You can listen to more podcasts by subscribing to ADIS Podcast with your preferred podcast provider or by visiting the journal website. For a full list of declarations, including funding and author disclosure statements, please read the article on the journal website.